I'm feeling so peaceful sitting here this evening. I thought I'd better start the Dhamma talk, otherwise it might be too late. So, while I was planning to talk about this evening, or what I thought of earlier of talking about, was the one of the central topics in Buddhist meditation, is the topic of samatha and vipassana. And for those who are interested to learn and to practice about Buddhist meditation, we will find these words get used, tranquility and insight. They're usually translated, sometimes serenity and insight. And we find that, of course, there's always that different people have different opinions about what they mean and so on and so forth. But the basic point here is something that's very simple, as always in the Buddha's teachings, and that is that when your mind is calm, you see things as they really are. And remember that very beautiful simile that the Buddha used of the still forest pool. When the water has settled down and become clear, you can see the weeds growing in the pool and the fish swimming around and the rocks in the pool and so on. So the calmness and the clarity of the mind, which is the samatha, is what enables the insight and the wisdom to happen. That's the vipassana. They work together. It's only in when we come to insist on the ideologies of these things that we start to see any kind of conflict between them. You know, in these days I've been practicing and studying these things for so long now, as soon as I hear any teacher starting to, you know, denigrate samatha or make a problem out of these things, I just switch off straight away. I can't be bothered. If someone has so little insight into the Buddha's teachings and so little understanding of how the mind works, that they can't see that calmness and peace leads to wisdom and letting go. If someone really can't see that, and if someone's saying, oh, don't be careful, if you get peaceful because you'll get happy and then you'll get attached to the happiness and ooh, like, come on. It's interesting how the course of our meditation, the course of Buddhism, is sometimes set or sometimes determined by very strange and apparently meaningless things. And just the other day I was doing a little bit of research for an article I'm doing on Buddhism and psychotherapy. And one of the crucial points on the relationship between Buddhism and psychotherapy is the idea of mindfulness. And mindfulness is used in the sense of non-judgmental awareness in psychotherapy. And it's interesting that the word non-judgmental doesn't have any Pali equivalent. There's no Pali word for non-judgmental. And the way of talking about mindfulness is really a product of the 20th century, not something that you can find in earlier discussions of mindfulness. It's not to say it's wrong, it's just to say it's a new way of talking about it, that's all. And I was looking at why we use the word mindfulness, and actually the earliest usage I can find is about in the 1880 or so. And it's in a book by Thomas Rhys Davids. I think the book is just called Buddhist Suttas. And one of the suttas that he translates there is the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. And that, of course, mentions the Noble Eightfold Path, one of the factors of which is right samadhi. Right mindfulness, right samasati. And he contrasts the earlier translation of that term with as right meditation. So an earlier translator had translated samasati as right meditation. And Rhys Davids was of the opinion that that was too narrow a term, and that would be, he suggested using the word right mindfulness. And the reason that he gave for preferring right mindfulness was the by referring to the passage in the Satipatthana Sutta that talks about maintaining mindfulness through and clear comprehension through all of one's daily postures. So of course that rendering stuck, and that's where the modern idea of mindfulness comes from. And it's very curious that it happened because of a discussion between some European academics 130 years ago, neither of whom had ever meditated or even had any idea what meditation was about. Of course, when they use the word meditation in those days, they don't mean what we mean by meditation. What they mean is a kind of reflective, contemplative thought about a higher topic, a philosophical reflections, something like that. So actually I think that the rendering of mindfulness as right meditation is actually not a bad rendering. And that what we're doing, for example, when we're doing anapanasati, translated as mindfulness of breathing, but you can equally translate it as meditation on breathing, or breath meditation, that's how we translate it, breath meditation. Now, we often find that this quality of mindfulness is said to be, of course, closely associated with vipassana or insight. But actually, when we look at the suttas, then we find that the quality of mindfulness is associated just as much with, if not even more, with samatha or tranquility. And mindfulness itself is not either samatha or vipassana, but it has something that underlies and informs both of them. So what exactly is that? What's actually happening? Well, I think the essence of that is most easy to understand when we think in the context of breath meditation, anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, or meditation on breathing, or breath meditation, or, as Venerable Tanisaro very nicely puts it, keeping the breath in mind. Actually, maybe that should be the rendering of right mindfulness, right mind keeping. That's quite a good one, isn't it? Right mind keeping. So the essence of anapanasati is keeping the breath in mind. Keeping it there. Not thinking about the breath. Not wandering off and thinking about this and that. But just being aware of that one thing. Continually. And it's that holding continually of awareness which is the mindfulness. Mindfulness is which is the dharana, the bearing in mind of that meditation object. Keeping attention focused in that same place, continually on and on and on. And one of the most powerful effects of that, if we can succeed in keeping awareness focused in that one place, on and on and on, is that the mind becomes calm. Becomes peaceful. And in that very moment, that thing which is so simple and in a sense is almost too obvious for us, is too obvious to need commenting on. But in there is a very powerful insight into the nature of awareness. How our mind is depends on what we do with the mind. By changing our behavior, by changing what we do with our mind, we change how our mind is. For somebody who's used to meditating, that might sound like it's such a commonplace, so trivial, that, you know, how could anybody see it differently? But in fact, the reality is most people most of the time have seen it differently. Throughout pretty much the whole tradition in Western philosophy, the mind is considered more or less tabula rasa, blank slate. The mind is pretty much something which is given. You can change what you do with the mind, but that doesn't really change the mind itself. And that assumption fed its way into even neuroscience until fairly recent years, when it was felt that once someone had reached adulthood, that their brain pretty much stayed the same, except it gradually deteriorated. And only in much more recent years, the last couple of decades, has there been a sort of strong proof and widespread acceptance of what they call neuroplasticity, which is essentially just saying in biological terms what the Buddha said in psychological terms, and that is that the way you use your brain will change how the brain is. The more you think in certain ways, those pathways will tend to become stronger, and if you neglect thinking in other ways or using your brain in other ways, those pathways will become weaker. And that's now very well established on a neurological basis. So not only is this idea something which is different from the mainstream idea in Western philosophy, it's also different from many ideas in religion. Because in many religions, there's a kind of belief in some kind of outside power, that safety, security, freedom, deliverance, these things are bestowed upon one by the grace of God, or a goddess, or something, however that you conceive that in the various different faiths that people follow in the world. And so again, underlying that notion is the idea that what oneself does is of relatively limited value, but the more important thing is being open to that external force, and it's from that external thing that one finds transformation or transcendence. And this is the way that many of the world's religious people think. Not all of them, obviously, but many of them. So from a Buddhist point of view, these ideas are not correct. From a Buddhist point of view, it's from our own choices, how we behave and what we do with our mind, which will condition and change how our mind is. By practicing in such and such a way, you will lead your mind to such and such a destination. This is a teaching on conditionality that the Buddha insisted on again and again and again. But this is not the only remarkable aspect of how the Buddha talked about meditation. Another aspect which I find always to be very, very striking in the Buddha's teachings, but which is perhaps so pervasive as to be not obvious. It escapes notice because it's so ordinary to us. And that is that the language that the Buddha used to talk about meditation, he always talked about simple, everyday, ordinary things that we can all experience and relate to. Again, this is a little bit related to that idea that meditation is something that comes from within rather than something which is bestowed from outside. So rather than talking about meditation in terms of like invoking the power of God or so on and so forth, the meditation is talked about in terms of recognizing certain kinds of inner qualities and then applying one's efforts to developing those qualities, the good ones, and to abandoning the bad qualities. And so that way of using language can be, of course, can sound quite mundane. Yeah? And that's again, I think, one of the characteristics of Buddhist language, is it's more down to earth. You know, if you say, well, the Buddha's teaching is to not do, to be evil, to do good, and to purify your mind, it sounds a bit kind of prosaic, doesn't it? You know, rather than saying it's Buddha's teaching, or the teaching is to be transformed through the loving grace of a creator God. It sounds much more exalted and sounds much more, if you like, inspiring or uplifting. But the way the Buddha talked about it is, it's much more grounded in the reality, much more grounded in what we actually experience. And whenever we want to try to understand these things, we always should start with those things that we're actually experiencing. Samatha and vipassana. What's samatha? Well, what are we actually experiencing? What is that calm that we actually feel? Inside each one of us, there's some degree of calm. This is something which is captured in the Pali Abhidhamma, which makes unification a factor in every mind moment. Even though that's a very different way of using the word unification than we find in the early suttas, but still, I appreciate the point that has been made there. So even though ordinary mind states are not obviously deeply unified in the way that deep samadhi is, but still, there's something unified about it. There's a wholeness there. And so, fair enough, at a time that we maybe feel very anxious or distraught or angry or scattered, then it might be very hard to say that there's any peacefulness there. But we're not like that all the time. There are moments like this when we're sitting together peacefully, when we don't have any deadlines, when we don't have anywhere else to be, when there's nothing to do but just sit quietly and rest and focus on the Dhamma. And in those moments, there's a certain degree of peacefulness. And in that certain degree of peacefulness, we can understand what it is that the Buddha meant when he was talking about samatha. Because when we feel that peace, there's a sense of meaning as well. There's a sense of understanding. There's a sense of connection. And this is something that, you know, you can feel if you're sitting indoors on a rainy day just watching the rain pelt down outside. Or if you're going for a quiet walk through the forest and just looking at the trees and the leaves and smelling the fresh air. Or if it's a clear night and you're looking at the sky. And all of these kinds of moments when there's a sense of peace, a sense of contentment. And there's something in those experiences, and I'm sure that you can recognize something of that, that there's a feeling of being apart, being connected in some way with something bigger, with the rest of what's happening. And in that moment of peacefulness, there's also clarity there. And in those moments of peace, we, in a way, kind of drop back into that which is important. The things that are significant and meaningful to us, they come. They just appear, as it were. We feel ourselves align with those things that are truly of value to us. Just naturally. It's not that we have to make an effort to do that, but it's more that those things that have been pulling us out of alignment, those things that have been confusing our sense of priorities, those things that have been distracting us from what's really important, they just kind of drop away and kind of like naturally come back into the alignment of where you are and what you're doing. So, in those simple everyday moments, we can see what it is that the Buddha was talking about when he's talking about the relationship between samatha and vipassana. that peace and that wisdom coming together. And the proposal is, if you like, the hypothesis which we're supposed to be testing is the hypothesis that if we develop our mind systematically through meditation, then we can experience that tranquility and that serenity to an even deeper level. And as our tranquility becomes even deeper, the sense of clarity becomes even deeper, then that sense of truth and understanding also becomes deeper. That sense of alignment with that which is of most value, it becomes stronger. It becomes, it's not like you're making yourself do that, but it's almost like you're realizing that that's where you in a sense were or should have been all along, dropping back into that. So developing the mind through meditation, through samatha and vipassana meditation, it means that we don't just wait for those random moments to feel peaceful. It means that we know how to bring the mind to peace whenever we want. Of course, we're still influenced by conditions around us, and that's only natural. But still, we have like a degree of control and power to shape the world that we live in, the inner world, the mind that we live in. And we have that refuge within us, no matter what happens. This is one of those very, very powerful things about meditation, which again I think is so obvious in a way that it escapes our attention. And that is how empowering it is to be able to say, I know how to bring my mind to peace. Nobody can take that away from me. It's very empowering, and it's also very challenging. Because the flip side of having power, of course, is that there's responsibility. And if you have the power to bring your mind to peace, you also have the responsibility to accept that if my mind is not peaceful, I can't blame anybody else. It's up to me to do that practice, not anybody else. So when it comes time for us to meditate and we sit down, we keep the breath in mind, or we keep the metta in mind, or whatever meditation that you're doing. You keep that in mind. Your mindfulness is the one that keeps that full in your mind. And you can feel yourself becoming one with that object. Thing which was separate and independent and out there, gradually you enter into it, becomes one. And as the feeling of separation disappears, the insight and the understanding grows. This is, I think, also perhaps an aspect of vipassana which is not as appreciated as it, much appreciated as it might be. Often when vipassana is talked about, it's treated in quite an analytical way. Vipassana means taking things apart. It's quite objective. It's like you're sort of dissecting your mind, like you dissect a laboratory rat. Take it apart and look at it. And certainly, you know, you learn things by doing that. Right? You learn things about rats by dissecting them. But there's a lot about rats that you don't learn by dissecting them. You don't learn how cute they are, for a start. You don't learn how they wiggle their nose. You don't learn how they relate to each other. You don't learn how they behave. What you have on the kind of dissected laboratory bench is not really a rat, it's just a bunch of organs. And the same way, if you just all you do in Vipassana is just dissect your mind into all these little bits, you don't end up with a mind, you just end up with a bit of bits on your laboratory table. To really understand something, you have to enter into it. Think about it. Think about how you would relate to, let's say, it could be anything. Let's say a book. Say you're reading a novel. You know, can you understand that book by sort of taking each word and defining each word in the book? Look, as every word comes along, you look it up in the dictionary, and you know what the meaning of each word is. Therefore, you've understood that book. Yeah, well, obviously that's not the case. Obviously that'd be ridiculous. I mean, you need to know what the words mean to understand the book, but that's only just the start of it. And I think that this is one of the problems that we find sometimes in the more Abhidhammic approaches to meditation, is, you know, that's one of the things the Abhidhamma provides. It provides dictionaries and definitions, which actually is helpful so you can understand it, just like a dictionary can be helpful to understand a book. It's only just getting started. Not really understanding something. If you really understand a book, you have to sympathetically enter into it. You have to identify with the characters in the book. You have to feel what they feel. You have to be happy when they're happy and sad when they're sad. And you have to, as well as entering into it and being emerging with that, but you also have to have that ability to step back from it and to appreciate how the novelist is making that happen, how they're making you identify and how the thing works. And both of those aspects are necessary. It's the same in meditation. This is really the trick, I think, to Vipassana and to understanding your mind, is to be able to, on the one hand, to fully immerse yourself in the meditation, to just be drawn into it and give yourself in that moment 100% to that meditation. But at the same time, to retain that ability to step back and slightly distance yourself. When I say at the same time, I don't necessarily mean at the same time in your meditation. I just mean one also develops the ability to step back, usually after the meditation, in fact, to step back and to reflect on it with a bit more distance. But still with that kind of sympathetic understanding, oh, how is that working? How is that going? And so it's by entering into that you understand. It's the same way if you want to understand how people in New Guinea live. You have to go to New Guinea and live with people. Learn their language. How do they speak? What are their customs? What are their beliefs? What makes them feel like that? Why do they care about these things? And you have to sympathetically enter into that. It's the same when you're just talking to anybody. You meet somebody, and if you want to understand them, you have to put yourself in their shoes. You have to sympathetically imagine why do they feel like this? Why is it that they care about this? What's actually making this real for them, or making this matter? And in meditation, the process of understanding in meditation is the same. We have to be able to go into the mind, into that state of peace, and just, in a way, just lose ourselves in that. Just be fully absorbed into that. And then we also have to have the ability to step back a little bit. What's going on there? Why was that like that? Why was that peaceful? Understanding. But still sympathetically understanding, rather than dissecting just for the sake of it. So this is how I see these two qualities of samatha and vipassana developing and working together. Different aspects of the same meditation. The tranquility leading to more wisdom, the wisdom leading to more tranquility. And our mindfulness, the practice of the actual act of meditating on a particular object, is the foundation for the development of both of these qualities. So that's my little talk for you this evening on Samatha and Vipassana. And I offer this for your reflection. And I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions.